Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Regeneration on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. Each week we talk with somebody who's making a positive difference and try to see the world through their perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Jack Brazil. Welcome, Jack.
Kia ora, Sam. How are you doing?
Very well. How's your bubble going?
Oh, it's excellent. I was quite lucky. We moved into a new house just before the lockdown, so we've had a nice time getting sort of settled in a new space and doing lots of gardening and, yeah, lots of cooking, which has been really, really lovely.
Who have you got in your bubble?
I've got my dog, my standard poodle, Safi. She's nearly 15, and two flatmates throughout the lockdown, and then we've just had three move-ins since level three has reduced, two move-ins, sorry. So yeah, there's about five of us now, and it's really nice.
Are you getting out and getting some exercise?
Yeah, that's been the nice thing about it is having that time to do so. So I've been getting out on the bike a lot, and it's been really nice having the lot less traffic lately. Not having to worry so much about cars coming up really fast behind you, getting into those dangerous situations, and yeah, just watching, listening to the birds and the roar of the ocean. I'm quite lucky to live next to the beach, so it's just been really delightful, really, to have that really privilege, big privilege.
So let's take some steps backwards and then come forward. Where did you grow up?
Born and raised in Dunedin. I've lived here for 26 years, actually. Lived in most suburbs around Dunedin, more houses than years I'm alive, which is quite a weird weird thing. But, from Waikwaiti to St. Leonard's to Harwood to Kaikoura Valley to Wakaroo to Musselburgh, and here I am in St. Clair.
What school did you go to?
Went to four different schools, which kind of went along with the house moving. So I started in Waitati School, went to North East Valley School and George Street Normal School, and then for my secondary education was at John McGlashan for 7 years. Yeah.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
It was actually quite a lot different to what I'm doing now, which I think is probably quite normal. I always wanted to be a vet, and I think that was a lot to do with just loving animals as a kid, and I was such a fussy child. I never wanted to eat meat. I never wanted to eat vegetables. And having my dog come into my life when I was about 14, and she had a lot of issues, a lot of fear and aggression. So I was just really wanting to help her, and I think that passion led to me wanting to be a vet. But then I never quite liked the science science classes behind it, so that kind of fell through.
What did you do instead?
So I ended up actually going, I started out in health science at uni, but I really didn't enjoy that. And then that led me along to studying French, which I'd been learning in school, and psychology. And then I was sort of a bit lost in my second year, not quite sure where I was wanting to go. And I'm not quite sure what actually made me decide that I picked up law in my third year of uni. And that was, that just felt like the right path to go. It made a lot of sense to me. Just sort of the justice sort of lines that I'd always been quite interested in. And I think I was a bit put off it because my mother's a lawyer, and just that classic not wanting to be shadow, I guess.
So did you finish law?
Yeah. So finished all my papers at law school, and that was in 2018. And so I spent the last year working in a commercial lease management software company, and I ended that mid-year to pursue environmental activism and community organizing, which is where my passions really lie now.
Was that something you were always aware of?
I think so. I guess, yeah, I grew up in a solo parent household with my mother and sister, and it was while mum was going through law school. So we were quite exposed to that, a lot of that kind of thought when we were younger. And mum just really exposed us to many different communities and just really drilled into us that message of care and compassion and not to be a bully and to help people. And we lived through some hard times growing up. So it was sort of, I guess that lived experience kind of made it more tangible and connected it. And I guess I just grew up not wanting anyone else to sort of go through those struggles, and knowing that while we went through struggles, that we were quite privileged still, and there are a lot more people who hit it a lot harder than us. So I guess just that sense of fairness, hearing that, oh, the world's unfair, life's unfair, that seeing the disconnect when, you know, we're in the 21st century, and we've got all this amazing technology, we have all the resources, so why isn't that being distributed fairly?
Certainly the justice would have come through in law, but was it the same justice as what you're interested in? I'm imagining there's a tension between a social justice and a justice.
Yeah, and I think that's what I really learned at law school. It felt quite black and white when I first started, and that, you know, understanding the law would help me just be a better lawyer and be able to help people. But I kind of had sort of the opposite of this effect. It kind of taught me how the law system is used by the privileged to as a tool to keep inequality in a place, to keep prisons filling up. And I just sort of would always hear the excuse that there's just too much, there's not enough resources. It's the courts are too overburdened, and it just never really felt right. And so I think that idealistic justice I had growing up, that I had the faith in sort of all of our institutions to do the right thing. I think the message I learned in there was that it's if we want the right thing to happen, we've got to do it ourselves, and we've got to put our passion into action, really, and follow through with that. So that's sort of where I think I am today.
Would adding care and compassion to law school be a... Could you bolt it on, or is it more fundamental than that?
I think it's a little bit more fundamental than that. I did a really interesting paper, one of my last at law school. It's called Legal Practice by the fantastic Bridget Troy Cronin, and it just had a really good critique on, I guess, hierarchy within law school, and how it's quite a competitive environment. You know, you've got 200-ish places to get into second year, and once you're there, then there's all that competition to do really well in there to get your summer internship and get your clerkship at a firm. And so it just really creates that culture of the opposite of collegiality. It creates that culture of sort of selfishness and needing to push others down to get ahead. And I think that in this paper really broadened on that theory, that kind of mentality is what upholds that legal hierarchy within New Zealand, and of which we've seen a lot of abuse within firms, particularly that Russell McVeigh case, which not to single them out, but it's within all those institutions. And I think it really taught me that it's the abuse of power around how hierarchy that is the issue. And that permeates through all institutions, not just law. So that's, yeah, I think it would take a lot, a big revolution in thinking to be able to address that systemically.
So after working for a bit, went over to the dark side, but I'll turn it around and say went over to the light side.
Yeah, that's how I like to think of it.
certainly over to the green side. What was that thought process?
I think it's what a lot of I think my generation and the younger generations are feeling today, is that sort of existential dread that can be quite likened to previous generations, you know, with the world wars, the nuclear crisis impending, and just this notion that there's this impending crisis happening. And that really scared me. It affected a lot of my mental health. And I think just as I was, you know, as the world was getting more and more connected, and community groups and front lines, environmentalists and Indigenous peoples were having their voices heard more, I was able to access that information more and kind of just make sense of it all and see what was happening around the world and really connect that. And I think my psychology education really helped with that. I tend to think a lot in systems, which has helped me feel less guilty in my role at being an individual and upholding that system. You know, like that classic, oh, how did you get to that protest? Oh, did you drive? And, oh, are those clothes made out of oil? Just really turning it to, rather than fighting in amongst ourselves, that classic united we stand, divided we fall, and really just shining the light on it's a political problem, it's a system problem, which felt really empowering to be able to do something. And, you know, there's something to be said for that. It's kind of a paralysis when you're so filled with anxiety and uncertainty that you don't know what to do. And certainly through my legal studies and learning psychology, that helped me understand where I could go and what I could do, and just the power as individuals that we have. Yeah.
And you would have got the electric train to Timaru, but there wasn't one. That's the point.
I wish there was. Yeah, I think that's that's a really exciting thing to talk about, because there's that Keep Dunedin Rail Rolling campaign going by the Rail Maritime Union, so Transport Union. So that's something that's on the horizon that would be really good to support. Because I see that's part of the Greens package, is to build the rail. It hasn't quite reached down to Dunedin yet, but that's hopefully what I'm looking to represent a bit more.
So you have been announced as the Green candidate for, it's not called South Dunedin anymore, is it?
Dunedin, it was Dunedin North.
Dunedin North,
Dunedin. Yep. So that's quite exciting. It's a huge privilege, and it's quite a lot to wrap your head around at first. I'm sort of a bit used to that spotlight from the activism, but it's a little bit different. It feels, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but it feels a bit more legitimate, because I think in the public's eye that activism isn't quite as the legitimate route. I don't agree with that, but it feels really good to do this and be able to engage the community more. And that's all I wanted to do, is really is work with the community, because there's so many fantastic groups and people doing all the mahi already, and it's just about uplifting that and highlighting, you know, how cool Dunedin is and what great things we have going here, and how we can build strong, safe and resilient communities in the face of the climate and collapse and the ecological collapse as well.
What sort of percentage does Dunedin get? It'd be hard to tell if it's, although it's gained the peninsula, so that will be progressive as well.
Yeah. I'm waiting for the full analysis and demographics on that, but historically Dunedin is the third highest Green membership in New Zealand, which is pretty exciting. And I think that's reflected in our Green Mayor, Aaron Hawkins, and just generally what I've felt within the activists and environmental community. There's a really strong hum of people who just want to create that change and work together, and that positive change with the principles of non-violence. Yeah.
So what are you hoping to achieve? What are you hoping to achieve?
I'm just really hoping to grow the people-powered movement, because I truly believe, you know, there's not going to be one thing that's going to save us all. It's not going to be technology. It's not going to be the government. It's not going to be, certainly not going to be a billionaire. It's going to be a lot of hardworking people and passionate people working together to build that better world. So I really want to foster that and build that and grow that and represent the green values and the kaupapa, because I that's why I joined the Greens, because of the principles of nonviolence, ecological wisdom, social responsibility, that we all have that responsibility to look after everyone, and appropriate decision making. So having the peoples affected within the communities affected of the decisions being made actually at the forefront of making those decisions. Because I think that's sort of been a problem I've seen growing up, is that successive governments have homogenized a lot of solutions and policies without necessarily consulting with the communities affected. So that's something I really want to emphasize and bring forward into this campaign.
Do you see a hierarchy of those things, or how do they work in terms of a system?
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to sometimes articulate. I guess it requires taking steps back into our history and looking at how we've got here in the first place. And so, you know, New Zealand is a settler colony from the British Empire, just as Australia, Canada, and the US are. And so it's looking at those systems and how they came about. And I think quite often the time we just sort of assume that things are just because they are, and that's the best way to do it. But I think under that thinking, it really neglects to show that the way we've constructed our decision makings and our institutions and who can be at the table making that decision is really kind of the logical extension of why we are here today. So it's really understanding the effects colonization has had on First Nations and Indigenous peoples around the world, the effect of the industrialization linked in with colonization that has had on the environment and the impact there. And it's just about thinking of outside how we've sort of made these decisions, because I'm not convinced that using the same systems will produce a better result. That's that my, I think it was my year 10 PE teacher first introduced me to that quote, only a fool does the same thing twice expecting a different result.
I think those four values, the relationships between them can be seen by looking at the opposite of each of them. Because if you can flip all of them into extractive or violence or... Mm. And I think that if you have that mindset, it makes it easier to see how those things together. One of the things that I don't understand is the people that say, if only the Greens would stick to the environment.
Mm. Yeah.
What's your answer to that?
I think that's been quite a common tactic to deliberately separate the intersections there, because I think there's a really beautiful Māori proverb. I can't pronounce it and remember it in Māori, but it's that what we do to the people, we do to the land. That's you know, the humans are intrinsically connected to the land, and I think that's summed up in the word whenua, which is the Māori, the reo word for land and also placenta. And so I think that is actually precisely the problem that our systems have done, is they treat every issue as an individual issue, but not seeing the intersections there. So looking at our health system, mental health particularly, it's quite often an internalized thing. It's as though, you know, you've got a mental illness and you're sick, but it doesn't really step outside and consider, well, why are people being sick? Is it because most people are working week to week and not earning enough money to meet their basic living needs? You know, that's a direct consequence of our economic and fiscal policies. And so in our government, are we seeing our Minister of Finance talking with our Minister of Health to talk about those intersections there? Because, you know, that's what makes life so beautiful, is the intersections. But when we come to a policy level and deciding about how we are going to decide decision makings, those intersections seem to go out the door. And that's probably the most frustrating thing I see in decision making, is not considering those and not seeing those links. Because I think that's quite a product of, I guess, a neoliberal way of thinking of individualizing everything, when in reality, you know, as a world, we are connected. And we've seen that now more than ever with COVID-19, that we have to work together, and how well we have in New Zealand worked together to ensure our safety. The idea that, you know, health is collective, it's not individual, And that old saying goes, we're only as good as how we treat our most vulnerable members of society. So, yeah, I'd say don't believe that. That it's a trick.
The Dunedin electorate is going to be fought between you and the Minister of Health and the opposition spokesperson for health. So you're probably right that health is going to be at the centre of their minds anyway. What are you going to contribute to that discussion?
I think just getting that nuance in there and understanding that you know, we can keep doing those band-aid solutions. You know, I'm so pleased we're building this new hospital. You know, we're needing to keep upgrading with technologically wise and making sure we have all those resources, but we can't keep treating health as this ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. We've actually got to look at preventative measures, and I think that's quite, you know, this is where we can learn from First Nations peoples and Te Ao Māori, looking at that, you know, there's all these preventative ways. If we're looking at health holistically, there's all these preventative ways we can actually address these issues so that they don't even end up being there. And I think the amount of money we spend on health as the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff is like astronomically bigger than if we just invested in children's well-being and families' well-being and all of those social inequality issues. If we actually invested in them, that would actually help further down the line with criminal justice. It would reduce the prison populations. It would, you know, it would reduce the mental health distress. It would reduce all of those negative social outcomes if we were actually to look at health as a holistic model rather than just focusing on sort of those acute symptoms of, you know, what you could imagine is of when you're feeling sick and going to the hospital. And it's not saying that we won't still have that, but it's broadening that horizon and looking at the whole picture rather than that narrow focus, which I think we've had for far too long.
What are you going to do to engage the young people? There were an awful lot of them real keen at the school strike for climate last year. So you have the advantage of being closer to their age, but that's not enough, surely.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I see a lot in these spaces this really refusal to engage with partisan politics, and I understand it completely. And I was like that myself, feeling really disenfranchised and disillusioned, and having no faith in politicians. And I remember at the rise of Extinction Rebellion last year, it being pretty clear that, you know, politicians aren't going to save us. And while I agree with that on a surface level, I think it's about looking at it as a movement and realizing that, you know, politics is just one branch of an entire movement where you've got the activists, you've got the domestic carers, you've got the community volunteers, and you've got all the ecologists and conservationists protecting the environment. And it's about working that together. And so I guess when I'm looking at these younger generations, I think it's just saying it how it is. I think it's, you know, too often politics has been disingenuous and too scared to be transformational, too scared to be radical. And that really puts people off because you can feel it. And I think younger generations are a bit different to, I guess, our parents' generations because we have all these opportunities and all these doors open, and whereas in the past we didn't necessarily have that information at our fingertips, and now being so connected we can do that. So I guess to answer the question, I'm not going to be afraid to speak my mind. I'm going to be listening to the needs of the communities, engaging them, hearing what they need. You know, I know my own experiences and what student communities are facing is crippling student debt, which locks you into a lifetime of having servitude and having to pay that back. I was just reading a fantastic quote by Noam Chomsky, which details that, you know, by the time students graduate, they're not only loaded with debt, but they have also internalized this discipline culture that makes them efficient components of this consumerist economy. And I think it's that rejection of that our younger generations are seeing, which is why we've seen those school strikes and all those hundreds of thousands of millions of young people around the world stand up and say they've had enough. So I think it's just really challenging. These stories we've been told is going to be a key part to that. And yeah, just building that movement, because people don't want necessarily to be told what to do. They empowered to be able to do that themselves. So it's fostering that.
How do we stop those excited young people becoming disillusioned, giving up? It's perhaps too strong a word, but maybe not giving up, maybe going along with that becoming part of the machine, which is the easy thing to do.
I think that comes back to that sort of saying, you know, you've got to lead by example and you've got to show that better path. Because I think you know, if one thing I've learned being involved in activism and dealing with my own mental health is that, you know, people are ready for the solutions and the answers. So but you've got to deliver them authentically. So I guess it's speaking to that. It's critiquing the powers and the problems, the big industries, the corporations that are destroying the world. But then showing that other way, showing that there's a solution. So I think that goes a long way to it, because I think it's extremely important to you've got to have a vision and a way forward to look forward to. Otherwise, you're just sort of floundering about, squandering. And if you're being too nihilistic, if you're being too sort of negative, you're not actually manifesting that positive change that you want to see in the world. So, yeah.
You were part of what has to be described as a successful awareness-raising campaign around the conference that was in Dunedin late last year.
Oh, the Minerals Forum Blockade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you trying to achieve?
So that was, I've been thinking about this a lot because it's actually coming up to 12 months that a year ago that this happened. And there were a lot of lessons learned. There was a lot of fun we had, and there was also a lot of sort of violence we experienced at the hands of some police and a lot of private security. So I guess the goal there was that, you know, we're seeing this worldwide trend of extractive industries dressing up these fossil fuel expansion projects as minerals forums to, I guess, shine the spotlight away from their, I guess, dirty energy investments and the environmental destruction. So we were pretty clear from the get-go with Chris Baker that we were opposing the fossil fuel expansion aspect of this, and we'd attempted to open up dialogue with them to talk about this, but they were pretty keen on keeping their propaganda sort of distracting away from that. And they came up with lines like, you know, like, oh, you've got a laptop, you've got a cell phone, we need, you know, you need those metals in order to make those things, which was never what this is about. This was entirely about fossil fuel expansion, and they were wanting to build more coal mines within Aotearoa. Which is just absolutely ludicrous, given that our scientists have shown us we can't even afford to burn existing fossil fuels that we already have extracted in order to stay below that temperature increase that to sustain life on this planet. So that was part of it. The other part of it was we were movement building, so we were wanting people to feel empowered that they could take action, because I think for too long, you know, this comes back to the issues around the justice system and the law, is that it's pretty clear that our law is not protecting us, and it's pretty clear that big corporations and big industries are pretty effective at lobbying politicians, certain politicians at that, and getting around those laws to keep up the environmental harm. And so that's where I think there's this sort of fallacy that people have around that, is that, you know, part of a healthy democracy is civil disobedience. You know, you've got to be able to have dissent in a society in order to actually have a healthy democracy. So that's what we were there exercising, was our dissent. And so everyone who was there was prepared to be arrested for public obstruction and preventing people from entering. But what that meant was that you know, we weren't there to be assaulted by people, but that's what happened. So we would have members of the Minerals Forum and members of private security and some police officers that had been flown down from Wellington, like a special riot squad, that were actually assaulting us rather than just arresting us and moving us on, say, if we were doing that. So that was quite interesting. So it's about movement building and making people feel empowered. I think we had close to 300 people that day turn up. And we were trying to show that there's a restorative way, a sustainable way that you can do this, because I think too often in people's mind they have this idea of activism and protesting as you're just an angry person with a sign causing trouble and vandalizing, which was just so far from the truth. So that day we had we'd spent about 7 weeks organizing this, preparing trainings for people to how to deal with conflict and de-escalation, because one of our principles is non-violence, so we're not wanting to hurt anyone. We wanted to keep the peace, and because we don't believe in that we need, you know, that, you know, I don't want to get out there with like a violent revolution and cause complete chaos. Yeah, and so we had that going. We had people who we prepared waiata music to help maintain the nice atmosphere. We had volunteers who were like, we call them green members. So they were people who weren't prepared to get arrested, put their bodies on the line, but they wanted to help. So they were people who were cooking food, checking in on people to see if they're okay, bringing them water. So we were just really trying to create, and I like to sort of call it like almost a festival. Like we're kind of wanting to create a fun vibe, you know, to really highlight that the people inside are being pretty antisocial by involving themselves in activities that are destroying life on this planet and further setting us to that that ecological collapse, and showing that, you know, we were the ones having fun, we were the ones actually enjoying it. So yeah, it was a lot to learn, and I think a lot of people were there that day. This was their first time doing something like this, so it was a huge learning experience. Now, we were pretty excited to have Jeanette Fitzsimmons, the late Jeanette, who died not too long ago, join us there. And that was a huge inspiration to me. And I think what helped me link a bit more faith in politics is that, you know, it's the working together. You can still be a politician, and you can still be on the front lines. You know, there's politics isn't for this class of people who are removed from society. Politics is for everyone. It's for the working people, it's for the unemployed, it's for the carers, it's for everyone's voice. And so I think it's a movement building is the, yeah. the answer. Yeah.
How much of that sort of activism is about social media? I mean, that Minerals Forum event played out perfectly on social media, and there were lots of people streaming it. What was the chant? We're nonviolent. How about you? All that sort of stuff came across really, really well, and also it looked really organised. When you know you could tell they've, you know, get people around to the back door. They're coming in through this door. That sort of stuff. So it's yeah. not just an orchestration, but it's also a curation of the message.
For sure, that was actually one of the highlights we'd heard from a fellow from a cafe worker, was that they'd had some delegates come in complaining how well organized we were. They were shocked. That was quite a badge of pride. Yeah, I guess there's a few elements in there, and social media in this day and age is really important in terms to be able to broadcast your message and get community buy-in and changing those narratives. But I wouldn't say it was about that. I'd say that's kind of the effect, that's the component in there. Because I think a lot of it, for me, what it was about was sending a clear message to fossil fuel corporates and those extractive industries that, you know, they're not going to be able to keep going on business as usual as they've been doing for the last century and beyond, with very minimal regard to human health, to the health of the land, of the clean water, of clean air, of the animal life that is impacted. So it was I'd say, you know, there's no one more than the other. It's all, you can't really supremacize it, that all of those things are working in unison. So as much as the social media, it was sending the message that, you know, we're not to be trifled with. The people in Dunedin here are pretty staunch. We've got a lot of conviction and we're prepared to stand up to a message. And I think that's evident that they've they'd scheduled the Minerals Forum to be in Hamilton this year. So quite far away from Dunedin. But I don't think they quite realised that wasn't going to stop us. But unfortunately, COVID put a halt to all of that.
You must have been pleasantly surprised when the Mayor, Dave Cole, in his keynote, which he was being criticised for giving because it was legitimising the forum, came out and told them that they weren't welcome.
That was really vindicating. I was really proud of Dave for that. We'd been talking to him leading up to that forum, and he was being pretty coy around, and whether he'd made up his mind about what he was going to say or not. You know, in our spirit, we kept up our advocacy and our activism, and I was actually one of the people, Christmas elves, that greeted him at the airport when he arrived back from, I think, a meeting in China. And we dressed up as elves and Santa and said, "Oh, Dave, do you want to be a good boy or a bad boy? We've got a nice almond tart or a lump of coal." And he took it quite well. And you know, we were just there to have a laugh, a few concerned looks from security because I was wearing a mankini. But yeah, I was really, really proud and happy. And I think that, you know, that contributed to me having a bit more faith in politics, that, you know, you can, and I think that's kind of the tide that's changing, is that that social license for activism and politics crossing over is coming back, and it's bringing it back to more the people. So yeah, cheers Dave, if you're listening. That was a really, really good speech.
And then I'm sure I've missed some other stuff, but the next time you came to the public attention was in Timaru.
Yes.
With a brilliant campaign, and I think this is the best phrase I've heard in a long time, on the hench ship.
The hench boat. We were
hench boat.
Hench boat. Hench ship. Hench boat. Same difference. Yeah. That was that all came about extremely fast. We'd been talking about it for a while, and it was just a matter of you're going to get the call up and drop everything and go. But yeah, that hench boat, we came up with it on the ship, actually. And we were, I'm glad you found that funny, because that was one of the things that kept us going while we were locked on the ship for those cold nights.
And again, that was about making it clear to those, to the actual, yep, the company, and actually, you know, physically stopping the totally activity. But it's probably more than that. It's probably more of the awareness, both to the public, yeah, and to those operators.
Yeah, so that one, that was, for me, that was quite a big one, because obviously there was OMV. They were attempting to drill just off our coast here, and they've been doing it up in Taranaki for a long time, and the wonderful people at Climate Justice Taranaki have been fighting that fight for a long, long time. But yeah, that one was the same thing. It was sending that message to that the Austrian oil giant OMV that, you know, they're not welcome here, and you're going to be opposed along every step of the way, and like, we were not going to get up. And as well, and I this didn't get picked up too much, was that, you know, it was, again, it's bringing in those intersections there. You know, it's not just about the fossil fuel expansion, it's about the harm that they're causing to the people and the environment. And OMV themselves are one of a few, three companies that are standing trial late this year for their war crimes involved in their oil operation. And so this was in South Sudan in 97 to 2003 that they operated the Block 5A oil permit, which saw 12,000 Sudanese people murdered and 160,000 violently displaced, many still to this day. Some horrific crimes included, and this is a complete breach of their obligations under the UN to ensure that their business activities were not harming people and the environment. And it's taken a long time for that to come to light, and because obviously the burden is on the people who have been so you know, screwed over by the operations to bring this together and to, you know, try and be legitimate and follow those legal processes, which are unlikely to even see the true reparation. And so that's the unpaid debt, a report by the UN in 2010, which details the just stomach-churning events that happened because of this oil extraction there. And this just is a indicative of what's happening all around the world with extractive industries. And it's actually today's the day acknowledging that like the Indigenous and First Nations women across North America that are being murdered and disappeared at extremely high rates around extraction sites, around those gas fields, around those oil pipelines, because it's inextricably linked. It's those intersections of the violence that people are doing to the land. It's also the same violence to the people. So it's highlighting that and the human rights abuses there that I think are extremely important, because I think we don't often talk about enough. We think of ourselves in New Zealand as this small little country at the bottom of the world, isolated away from all those awful things happening overseas. But we don't often talk about how our role in the global trade scene and the global affairs actually is complicit in upholding all those harms. So that's a huge thing for me about justice, is acknowledging that, you know, there's no justice unless there's justice for everyone. And that has to be a part of the conversation. So that was what personally I was thinking about a lot when I was locked onto the ship for 51 hours, was those people who lives have been destroyed and are still destroyed. There's that saying that goes, you know, we call them underdeveloped countries because countries ruthlessly pillaged and destabilized by foreign powers doesn't quite have the same ring to it. So it removes those things. To remove the responsibility that we all have in, as global citizens.
After Timaru, you chased the boat up to Taranaki. Eventually, were part of some really nice work on the, what was it called, the Museum of Oil Industry or something?
The Museum of Oil Industry? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, something like that. That was... we actually didn't know about that. We knew there was a surprise coming. Some dedicated old activists, had been working on while we were occupying OMV's headquarters. And so they all thought we were finished by Wednesday night. And we went back to the lodge, and here was this absolutely phenomenal, fantastic art installation, the Museum of Natural Oil History, that we put up in the car park at OMV's headquarters. And it was just to bring back to their minds, actually, you know, I think sometimes they can feel a bit removed from the harm they're causing in their office building. And so it was to bring back to them, actually, this is what the harm you're causing to the people in the world. So we had, there was a burning koala teddy bear art installation. There was a bird that had been drowned by, there's not a real one, a bird that had been drowned by the oil slick spill. You had a and all of these ones were sort of filled with treacle, so it made it quite a hassle to be able to move. You had a big what are they called, those oil I should know this, but it's the oil fracking model at the top, and you had an art installation of the picture, and it had a telephone, a mock one, the very telephone the National MP Jerry Brownlee used to talk with OMV executives to create these dodgy deals. So yeah, it was quite impressive, and I think that's one thing I've really enjoyed about activism, is bringing the art to it, because I think it comes back to that whole thing, you've got to make it fun, you've got to make it regenerative, you've got to make it sustainable, and those kind of things, like just seeing the delight on all of our faces and the energy there, the interactions with the public going by who just loved it. You could even see some of the smirks on a few of the police officers' faces. So it was you know you're winning when even the police are smiling.
Did they ever find you to serve the trespass notice?
No. I think they got a bit scared, because I think they were following sort of a trend of and linking into our work for environmental justice, Utiputi, of trying to scare us with preemptive trespass notices, they'd served, the police had served one on their own accord, which was very dodgy, to a friend of mine over the Western Saharan stolen phosphate in Ravensdown there. And I think OMV were trying to take a leaf out of that book and play into the intimidation. But they knew that I was just going to make a mockery of it, because that's what it is. It's a mockery. And an international company trespassing me, and, you know, it's pretty ridiculous. So, you know, I'm still waiting for it, basically. I don't know if they will. But it was quite handy, because they actually, we only knew of about half of the sites they trespassed me from, so they actually gave us quite a handy list of good targets.
Okay, so I have some questions to end with, and we've got not that much time, so we have to go quick. What's your go-to definition of sustainability?
I think that is, that's looking at what we can use to sustain ourselves, to keep our life going, that is in keeping with the natural environment, the natural, our ecosystem. So it's not taking too much that we're harming the earth. And it's looking at those sort of those models of the donut economics by Kate Raworth and indigenous practices about how we care for Papatūānuku here.
Of all of the changes we've seen in the last 6 weeks or so, what do you think is going to stick, or at least what do you hope will stick?
I'm not sure if this will stick without us coming together and building that people-powered movement, but just the quiet. I was speaking to a woman the other day, and she said it reminded her of her childhood and what community used to be like, meeting your neighbours, speaking to them, all the bird life that has come back. I saw whales and a whale and its calf and outside my window and a whole pot of dolphins. So I hope that sticks, the peacefulness, recognizing that, you know, it's we've reached this peak of you know, technology and human growth, that we just need to slow down a bit for our own health and the health of our planet, really.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes. The team of people doing good works. So you're in our mansion. What's your superpower?
Oh, just making people feel better. I think that just when you feel good, you're inspired to do good. So it's that karmic principle, I think. Yeah, I'd like to do that. That's my goal.
I think there's an obvious answer for this question, because you've already answered it, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Actually, I'd like to diverge a little bit. You know, I am an activist, but I'd like to think of myself as a land protector, because that's ultimately what we're doing, is we're protecting the land and protecting the moana, the awa, the water, the birds, the bees.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Just knowing that we can do it, and that we, you know, anything we do, we're already winning, because ultimately this is where the world is going, and it's the other dinosaurs, the fossil fuel execs, the corporate oligarchs that are maintaining, clutching on to this old toxic way of ruling the world, and that, you know, there's a better way, and it's coming.
It's interesting that you say there's a better way, because the response that they will have is, Jack, you want to take us back to the caves?
Mm. I think that's quite a funny reply, because it's like, well, that's not only impossible, because, you know, here we are, but it's ignoring that, you know, we have all this technology, we have all this knowledge, that's not just going to disappear. So it's just about being centering people first and the environment first. You know, that old, you know, people conflate capitalism with simple commerce, which has happened forever. It's just actually reprioritizing who's benefiting. And it's not going to be the billionaires. You know, it's that, as I'm hearing a lot lately, the world cannot sustain billionaires, because billionaires, by virtue, mean people living in poverty, because they're consuming far beyond their own resources and any work that they actually truly do. No one can do enough work to earn billions of dollars.
What challenge are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
In the next few years? Learning how to build a garden and grow food and all those permacultural principles that we are going to need for food resilience. You know, lessening our need for pesticides and industrial agriculture techniques when we can actually do all of these things ourselves and just connect with the earth more. And it's something I've been learning a lot more lately, especially during lockdown. And it's hard.
You've been gardening?
Lots of gardening, yep. We've been doing this fun technique we call lasagna, where we mulch the ground. You've got your cardboard, you've got your compost, you've got your matter, and it creates these layers perfect to put your veggie garden in.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would you have happen?
I would have every child in this world fed and in a warm house and with the tools to continue that themselves. I think, there's no reason why we can't do that other than greed.
What's the smallest thing we could do with the biggest impact towards that?
The smallest thing we could do is to ensure guaranteed income for everyone. There's the talk of universal basic income. If everyone has the means to which they need to survive, so the income coupled with universal basic services, that way that would actually truly mean everyone was at the table working together. Because I think where we're at now is there are a lot of people disenfranchised, unable to participate. So I just want to make it so everyone can participate and have their say in how we create this this more healthy, equitable world. And that's actually pretty easy to do.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Find out what your passion is and go and do it. Talk to people. There's a Yale study that said the most effective thing you can do about climate crisis is to have the conversations with people, because it's in those conversations the magic happens. It's in there that you find those common grounds and you get inspired and empowered to do things. And when you find that passion, go find people that have that passion and do that thing, and then support other people doing their passions, because it's that collective that's going to do it. You know, we can create this world together, and we're doing it.
I said last question, but I've just thought of another one. How do you think that the campaigning is going to play out over the... are we going to get let out? Or how's it going to work? Are you prepared for all eventualities on that one?
Definitely, yeah. We're talking about this and seeing what we can do. I think in general campaigning, and this is why I'm running, is because I just want to bring those values there. I think too often politics plays into the fear, and it plays into blaming people who are quite often marginalised and going through struggles themselves, whether that be immigrants or beneficiaries, and that's just, it's gross. And I'm here to put those good values, and I think that's going to be a really important thing to do in our global politics, given what we're seeing overseas.
Well, best of luck to you. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much. Have a great night.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Regeneration on radio. Each week we talk with somebody making a positive difference and try to see the world through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens has been that of Jack Brazil, who is the Green candidate for Dunedin. You can find podcasts of Sustainable Lens on oar.org.nz and the archive on sustainablelens.org. You can find us in all the poddy sorts of places as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and streaming of primo local content. Download the accessmedia.nz app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.